cowboys and Indians, settlers and treaties, blah, 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 blah. Like I'll ever remember in 10 years, the Homestead Act of 1862. I'm just a white boy, attracted to the color, disconnected from my roots. So I reach for another's, I'm discovering power and beauty in Lakota culture, like the sacred eagle. But I feel like a vulture, dancing on the graves and singing the songs. I just want a community where I belong. Grandfather, why did our family come out west? This is not where we came from. How did we get that land that the ranch was on? He says his father, my great-grandfather, brought the family out from Missouri and settled the ranch as a homestead, a free land grant from the government. 270 million acres of stolen Native American land, 10% of the country, given to white people for free. First, the army invaded with firearms and fire water, burning death across the plains. Within 10 miles of my family's ranch is a national historic site. The Dull Knife Battlefield. Come with me to the bitter end of life at the clandestine campgrounds of Chief Dull Knife. Nestled in a valley of sage and evergreen trees, herds of horses, fire pits, and teepees. Families sleep and the sun begins to rise as the morning quiet is murdered in deafening surprise. Storming, thunder of hooves and battle cries. War songs echo as the first bullet flies. You a soldier riding out of hiding, guns blasting, attacking the Cheyenne village in fast action. The troops hunt men, women, and children. The valley stinks with the stench of killing, 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 killing. Cost of free land. Can you imagine the cost of free land? I now know the history of the ranch and that land in Wyoming. But what went down here in Oakland? Who lived on this land? What happened to them? Digging down. Ooh, ha! 1999. Down beneath sidewalk and street. Mall construction disturbs buried bodies. Ohlone ancestors sleep for thousands of years. Wake up to the sound of blaring bulldozers scraping their souls into steel boxes. Some bones so toxic they feel like rubber. So drunk off chemical cocktails they're handled and disposed of as toxic waste. Others buried in unmarked mass graves. Hundreds removed from their resting place to create space for the foundation of the new mall. Say nothing about Ohlone burials, nothing about the thousands of bodies already removed, nor the hundreds that remain, nothing about the vibrant Ohlone community alive today. After all the bloodshed, generations of war, after all the broken treaties of lies and brute force, after 500 years of colonization, the broken backs and heart attacks that built this nation, we stand on stolen land, with the past in our hearts and the future in our hands. Are we prepared for the changes of character, breaking the barriers in Native America? How can we carry the legacy and move forward as builders, teachers, artists, healers, warriors?
It's my great pleasure to welcome Ariel Luckey to our show today. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's really a pleasure to sit down and talk with you because I came across your performance piece on YouTube called Shell Mound, and I was so struck with it, and I was very pleased to learn that you're in the Bay Area so that we can sit down together. And Shell Mound, we just heard a clip from it, and I wanted to talk with you, Ariel, about that piece, how it came about, and how it's been received, and let's talk about how it came about.
Absolutely. So the Shell Mound story is actually an excerpt of a larger piece called Freeland, which is a full evening-length one-man show. It's 90 minutes long. And the Shell Mound story comes towards the end. So let me back up a little bit and give you a context for where the Shell Mound fits into this larger story. Freeland is my one-man show. It's an autobiographical piece.
And it starts with my childhood, you know, growing up in the Bay Area and learning, you know, like every kid in this country does, about cowboys and Indians and, you know, Native Americans and, you know, stuff happened to them a long time ago in history, and it was all very sad, but that's, you know, kind of distant and somewhat irrelevant. And then it follows my journey as I grow up and learn more. And as a young man, I decided to interview my grandfather. I wanted to learn more about my family history and my roots. And so I was interviewing him, and he grew up on a ranch in Wyoming in the 1920s. And, you know, during that era, there was no water, running water, they didn't have electricity. This was like the wild, wild west, right? This was the west back then. So I was asking him more about his childhood, trying to get a sense of my family history. And I asked him how we got that land that the ranch was on. He said it was a homestead, a free land grant from the government. Now, that was the first time I had ever heard that term before in my family. You know, we had always referred to it as the ranch. And so when I heard it was a homestead, that kind of shifted something and kind of struck something in me. And I started, you know, asking more questions. Okay, is free land okay? The government gave it to our family. Well, who lived on that land before our family? And I asked my grandfather, and he said it was empty. Now, I knew enough to know, of course, that land was not empty. There were Native Americans who were living there before, but, you know, I had no idea who in particular and what had happened to them. So I started doing research, and I found out that that on that very same piece of land, in 1876, there was a major battle between the Northern Cheyenne and the U.S. Army. The Army attacked the Cheyenne as they were sleeping at dawn, killed a bunch of people, sent a lot of them off into the winter without any supplies. It was just this, you know, horrific thing that happened. And once I found that out, you know, the connection was really clear that, you know, if that battle hadn't happened and the Cheyenne hadn't been kicked off their land, my family wouldn't have gotten that ranch, and, you know, my life would have been really different. And, you know, that, you know, that set off a whole journey, and I ended up doing a bunch of more research and actually going to Wyoming with my grandfather and mother, having a whole experience there, meeting the people, finding the ranch, finding the battlefield, all of this stuff.
Did your grandfather know any of that history?
No, he hadn't known. He hadn't known it at all, and wasn't particularly interested either. Mm-hmm. So I did this whole journey, and all of this is in the show, Freeland, before the Shellmount story. And when I come back to Oakland, having learned, you know, this whole history of that land in Wyoming and met the people and thought about it and gone through this whole process, I realized that I didn't really know anything about the history of this land. Even though I was born in Oakland, I've lived here all my life, that, you know, this is also stolen Native American land, but I didn't really know anything about who had lived here, what had happened to them, what the story of this land was, even though, you know, I've gone to 16 years of formal education, lived here all my life. That information was never, you know, given to me. So again, the questions started coming, and I, you know, felt really compelled in doing the research, and that led to the Shellmount story as it is now, kind of documenting my journey into the history of this land and then grappling with what I find.
And tell me about the process of grappling.
Well, it's hard, you know. It's really painful to learn what happened here, what has happened here. It's not a pretty history. There's a lot of really ugly realities. The violence of the mission system, the legalized slavery in this state during that time, the corporal punishment, you know, the Ohlone were whipped and beaten. They were not allowed to practice their spiritual faith. They were not allowed to speak their language. Families were ripped apart. It was, you know, a really horrific time. And that was really just the beginning. You know, then came the gold rush era and, you know, everything after that. So looking back and learning all of that history, you know, I had to figure out what I was going to do with it. How did I feel about it? How did it relate to me? How did it create the world that I live in now? And I, you know, most of us kind of walk around and take for granted. The connections were there and were really clear. So, you know, I included part of the Shellman story. There's a song called The Red Poem where I'm really reflecting on those questions and, you know, okay, well, I'm still a white man with white skin privilege living on this land, you know, benefiting from being able to be here. How am I implicated in this story? What does that mean for me? And then, you know, what does that mean for my relationship with the Ohlone today? You know, there's Ohlone folks who are here right now, living in Oakland, living in the Bay Area. What does that mean in terms of my responsibility or my relationship with the Native American community and supporting them around the political struggles that they face now?
And I want to talk about that part of it also. When you were going through this, the grappling part of, you know, who you are and how you got here, did you have a support system? Who were you talking with about that, and how were they receiving the information?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I shared a lot of it with friends. I mean, I have a community of artists and activists who I work with and connect to. You know, both my family, both my parents have been really supportive, and my wife. And throughout the process, I was also sharing pieces with some of the Ohlone folks that I know in the community, bouncing the information off them and asking them for guidance around accuracy and clarity. And so it was the development of the show was very much a group process and a collective, you know, collectively informed process. My director and I did a lot of public performances, works in progress, you know, where we would have dialogue sessions afterwards to get feedback from the audience as we were developing the play. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think one of the points of the show for me is that, you know, we have to look at this history. We can't pretend that it didn't happen. We can't, you know, close our eyes and it'll just disappear. And it is really painful, but we can do it together. Mm-hmm. And trying to look at it, you know, or deal with it on your own doesn't work.
You must have also got a lot of people telling you that, well, that was the past, that's history, this is the way life is, and this is what you got now. Variations on that.
Sure. Yeah, you know, it's interesting because especially here in California in the West, it's so recent. You know, we're talking of, you know, the gold rush was 150 years ago, 160 years ago. In the span of human civilization, if you think about China, you think about Iraq, if you think about, you know, these cultures and civilizations that were around for thousands of years, Europeans have only been here for, you know, the Spanish came a couple hundred years ago, but all of my, you know, white people only came here about 160 or so years ago. So in the span of time, that's just a blink of the eye. And it actually really is very present and recent. And you see, you can look around and you see, you know, you have the impact of the Spanish and the culture. I mean, obviously, lots of people speak Spanish. You have the mission in San Francisco, the mission in San Jose. There's a lot of the imprint of that history in our landscape today. And so it's not hard to make the connections of how this is still really very much living with us.
And Ariel, Shell Mound actually, I believe, refers to the Shell Mound in Emeryville.
The Ohlone created Shell Mounds all over the Bay Area. The one in Emeryville was the largest in the whole Bay Area. It was over 65 feet tall and 350 feet wide. It was bigger than a city block. Ships could navigate around the bay by locating the shell mound. It was a very large phenomenon. But there were shell mounds all around the bay, and there still are. The one in Emeryville has been almost completely destroyed. It was leveled in 1924, and now is the site of the Bay Street Mall. And it was, you know, but it was, before it was destroyed, it was in an archaeological site of global significance. You know, it had been created over 4,000 years. It had thousands of human remains and, you know, artifacts jewelry, pottery, arrowheads, etc., was there, most of which was destroyed wholesale by the folks who leveled the shell mound.
What's interesting particularly to me is this idea of trying to come to grips with it in a larger, you know, it being how we got here, mm-hmm. and what we did to get here, we being the white sort of hegemonic people that are here right now. There's a lot of resistance to actually facing that, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is that it doesn't reflect well on, you know, like my ancestors and, you know, quote unquote white people. You know, you notice this in, you know, when people are telling their family history or even speaking of someone who's passed away, there's a general tendency to only say the nice things about a person or about, you know, the family or whatever. And I think, you know, that's a natural kind of human thing. You want to look good and, you know, it reflects on ourselves. But for me, part of it is, you know, a real clear commitment and value to the truth, you know, and really being clear about what is true, not just what looks good. And, you know, the other part of that is that I think there is an inherent implication for action for now. You know, acknowledging the injustices of the past clearly makes us in some ways complicit with injustice that's happening now, and unless we're kind of prepared to do something about that and be involved in, you know, a million different ways, you know, it doesn't lend itself to passivity. So if someone just wants to be passive and live in a, you know, bubble and a privileged life, then bringing up these topics can be really uncomfortable because of the implication for action today.
But also, if you don't necessarily want to just be passive, but you want to very actively work against looking at that truth, and I think that there is a tendency in this United States to feel like, you know, this is manifest destiny, we deserve this because we fought for it. And so, in other words, a very active fight to maintain the cover.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you see that right now in Texas as they're rewriting some of the history textbooks, eliminating key figures of color from history like Cesar Chavez, or in Arizona where they just recently outlawed ethnic studies. You know, I think if someone's purpose is white supremacist, you know, to be blunt about it, and in that they are trying to glorify the historical exploits of white people, minimize the contributions of people of color, and the, you know, genocide against people of color that has happened in this country, then that is what it is. You know, it's not honest. Like I said, I mean, I think it's part of it is about coming back to reflecting the realities of what really has happened. And it's certainly not democratic or multicultural. It's not reflective of the society and including all of the members of our society that we live in today. But absolutely, there are definitely strong elements of folks doing that in our society right now, trying to rewrite the history. So, you know, I think what I'm trying to do with my work is, particularly from a white perspective, reflect on that as honestly and clearly as I can and, you know, hopefully engage people in dialogue who are open to really looking at what it means. Because I think that there is a cost to it. One of the questions in my show that I raise is, what is the cost of free land? And what I mean by that is, you know, how does being the descendants of the perpetrators of genocide impact us, you know, spiritually, emotionally, psychologically? How are we living with that? You know, people talk about the post-traumatic slave disorder, right? We know they've done studies that show that for the descendants of slaves or the descendants of genocide, there are psychological costs. There are, you know, this emotional legacy that people live with. What does that mean for folks on the other side? You know, for the soldiers who slaughtered men, women and children at Wounded Knee, at the massacre of Wounded Knee. What does it mean to be the descendants of those people? You know, I think there is an inherent benefit to doing this work and looking at the past and, you know, ultimately move towards some sort of healing. you know, there's been examples of, you know, the United States government made a formal apology and had the reparations for the Japanese internment camps. And some people, you know, see that as just a token and symbolic, you know, not very grounded, you know, step. But it is a formal acknowledgement. You know, it's not everything. It's maybe not as much as needed. But in a lot of ways, we as a society have never really come to terms with the genocide against Native peoples in this country. And, you know, you see that in the racism today, the mascots for the sports teams, the Native mascots that are still prevalent, the, you know, use of Native American imagery all around the country. There's a lot of ways that that those patterns are continuing now.
It also allows, when we go to war, for example, with Iraq and now Afghanistan, or Afghanistan and Iraq, it also allows us to maintain or continue the sense of name-calling, right? Othering people, the ragheads and so forth. And that discussion never sort of comes about either, you know, what's okay for troops when they're out there being sent off to foreign lands. That whole thing is wrapped up, isn't it, in this same conversation?
Absolutely. It's very much the same process of colonization. And in fact, there were soldiers in Iraq who were using some of the language of the West, you know, calling it the frontier, talking about cowboys and Indians. Of course, them being the cowboys, the Iraqi soldiers, and I mean the U.S. soldiers and the Iraqi people being the Indians. So, yeah, it's very much a part of, I think, the psyche of our country. And when they start working up the nationalism and the propaganda and the patriotism to support their, you know, extravagant and horrific war efforts, I think it is very much in the model that, you know, really this country has been founded on. You know, we've been in almost continuous warfare since the beginning of the United States, domestically and abroad. And it's a, you know, very key part of our economy to, you know, people talk about the military-industrial complex. So, absolutely, I think there are lots of connections to be drawn. It's, you know, again, it's one of those things of like, well, what are we going to do now? You know, okay, we can't go back to 1876 and undo that battle, right? That's in the past. We know it happened. But what can we learn about that? And how can that inform our public policy today, both domestically and internationally? Mm-hmm. We actually just released a DVD of the full show, Freeland, that includes the Shellmound story in it. And I'm working right now on a study guide that will release this fall that will go along with the DVD so that teachers around the country can show the movie, show the film in their classrooms, and then do follow-up work with their students. And looking at the Shellmound story in particular, one of the things that I think is really powerful for students is for them to learn the history of the land that they live on, which is the process that I went through in creating and developing the Shellmound story. It really can change the way you see the world. I mean, literally, when I walk down to Emeryville or through parts of Oakland and Berkeley, I understand those places and my role in those places differently because I know the history of that land and how all of it has come to be. So what we're doing with the study guide is using the model of the Shellmound story, which is, you know, taking a single place and digging down. And as we dig down, we're moving back in time. So, you know, we go through the major eras of historical significance of a particular place of location. And using that as a model to help teachers teach local history for their students. You know, unfortunately, there is a version of this story everywhere in the country. I've traveled nationally and performed this piece and met with students and teachers and done a lot of work in schools. And everywhere I go, there is a local story of the colonization, of the genocide. You know, who the Native Americans were, and when the Europeans came, and then what conflicts and struggles and massacres and battles and, you know, what happened, how the Native folks resisted, how the Europeans dominated, you know, just what the dynamics were. And there's lots of variation. I don't mean to simplify it in any way, but it is a common national history. that unfortunately we share, so that students can learn that history anywhere in the country. They can, you know, they can watch the Shell Mound story and learn the history of here, of Oakland, the Bay Area, and then apply that same lens to their own land, their own homeland, and learn that history. You know, I think it's important, and like you said, sadly missing from a lot of current education, I think it's important for students to know the names and some of the culture of the Native folks who have traditionally lived on their land. A lot of times those Native folks are still there. They're often invisibilized or marginalized in some way. A lot of times they're still there. Sometimes they're not. If our attempts to educate students is to make them responsible citizens and informed people in the world, I think it's important for them to know something about the Native American history of this country, of the land that they live on, as well as what happened when the Europeans came. So, and in it, in my experience working with students, young people really get excited about local history. It's tangible, it's local, it's relevant, it's present, and it's not as abstract as, you know, somewhere far away like China or Europe or wherever. You know, this is about stuff that happened in their very backyard and relates to where they live. That's actually a spark for students to get excited. A lot of times they find history really boring. And part of what I'm trying to do with the Freeland Project is really invigorate and vitalize history studies so that it's relevant, it's interesting, it's artistic, and it's political, so that students think critically about the issues that are in their lives today.
And how can teachers get in touch with you if they want to know more about that?
The best way is to just go to my website, which is www.ariellucky.com, ariellucky.com. You can also go to the freelandproject.com, www.freelandproject.com. If you're interested in the study guide, sign up on my email list and I'll send you an update when it comes out. There's also lots of information, samples of Freeland and the Shell Mound, photos, biographies, all kinds of information on the website.
One of the things that I've been struck with is there's a Native American chief here. He's called the Rumsanilone Chief Tony Cerda. And I saw him, I was at some ceremonies that they were doing in Hunter's Point, and one of the things he said about his dancers at the end of the dance performance for an audience was, well, next time somebody tells you that the Ohlone people have all disappeared, you tell them you saw them dancing here today. And I always get so touched by that, mm-hmm. because there's Ohlone all over the place.
That's
and
right.
The history of the Ohlone has made it such that they've felt like they needed to hide out and submerge their cultural background.
Well, and a lot of times also they've been either ignored or invisibilized or, you know, pushed out from the history textbooks. You know, students are required in the state of California in the fourth grade to learn California history. And if schools were bringing Ohlone speakers in or, you know, involving, and there are some amazing history teachers out there who are doing that, don't get me wrong. But in general, as a culture, as a society, you know, most of us pretend that they don't exist, that they're not here anymore. And so it is really powerful just to acknowledge that. I have a friend who's lived here in Oakland, and she can trace her family back for generations and generations to pre-Spanish times, all of people who have lived here in on this land right here in Oakland. Mm-hmm. And that's a powerful thing. I think it's amazing, and it's important for everybody to acknowledge that, mm-hmm. recognize, you know, that most of the rest of us are pretty recent immigrants.
Thank you for being with us today. So that's Ariel Lucky, ariellucky.com.
That's right.
Or thefreelandproject.com.
It's www.freelandproject.com.
Freelandproject.com. Thanks.
Thank you so much.